Vehicle surged forward, burst through the ornate bronze and iron gate at 150 kilometers an hour, spun and skidded to a halt under the pendulum arc of one of the ropes. A slim figure in white nun's robes was zipping up the rope under power. The chopper canted forward, the quiet whoop-whoop of its blades grew slightly louder, and it began to move forward and up. The rope was swinging back at them, but the bottom of its arc was rising as the helicopter picked up altitude. The end of the rope was going to hit their position at ground level, at chest height, at head height, at 3 meters, four, rising. Fang slammed open the door, jumped onto the hood of the car, then the roof, took 2 steps and leapt out and up into the air, more than 3 meters up and 3 meters out. He hung in midair for a split second, one arm extended, a man in mid-leap, legs akimbo, detached from the earth, soaring through the night sky at a slender line that was swinging back towards him, but rising ever higher as it did. Fang snagged the very end of the rope with his black-gloved left hand as it hit the bottom of its arc. He roared in triumph. The Confucian fist hung there for a moment, swinging beneath the chopper. Then he brought his gloved right hand up to join his left. He grinned up savagely at the chopper, a maniacal Asian man in a black chauffeur's suit, and began to climb hand over hand. Sam reached the chopper, used the last of the momentum from the powered ascender to flip herself up and in through the wide door. She ducked as something whistled through the air above her head. A seal kicked at her in the tight space, and she dodged, spinning to the side. Another smashed at her with the butt of his rifle, and she threw him into the man behind her. One of the seals pounded a red control, and the doors she'd come through slammed shut. Oh, fuck.
"We've got her," Bruce Williams said. "Canary and Blackbird both on Banshee 1, headed back our way. Banshee 2 is 20 seconds from loaded."
"Combat! Combat!" Jane Kim yelled. "Two Royal Thai Air Force fighters inbound. They're hailing, demanding that the Banshees both set down."
"Lose them in the clouds," Becker said from screen 3. "Get our choppers back."
Shu reached out to the car, subsumed control of its electronic warfare capabilities, activated the high-gain directional antenna embedded in the roof. Through it, she felt around the edges of the chopper's electronic presence. Where was the way in? Every system had a hole. Every system. She just needed to find this one. The Americans were jamming local transmissions. Shu rooted around that, flipped to a frequency far outside normal bands, connected with her higher self. Shu swam in a luminous storm of data. Her higher self dug deep into top-secret Chinese military and intelligence databases for more about the XH-83 Banshee. Where was that hole? Where was it? Sam whirled in the tiny space. Cade was bound and gagged in the corner, his one eye wide. Two of the SEALs were down, apparently dazed by the grenade. The other four came at her.
"Use their bodies against them,"
Nakamura had taught her.
"One can defeat many."
She let her Wing Chun take control of her. No drug clouded her mind. No rage from other minds confused her. She let her practice speak through her body. She was a stalk of bamboo. She was a summer storm. She was a whirlwind. She was made for this. They came at her with fists and legs and knives and rifles used like clubs. 4 of them. Spin, dodge, strike. Take the knife away. Dodge, spin, sweep. Get that one off his feet. Spin, spin, block. Lure that one in close. Strike, spin, throw. She sent one of them hurtling into another at point-blank range. Heads collided. They went down in a tangle of limbs. Block, block, dodge. The other two closed around her, backed her towards a corner. Kick, feint, roll. She came up free behind them. They were fast. She was faster. Kick, spin, strike. One of them went down. Another came back up from the tangled pile. Block, spin, throw. She rammed one into another, made them her puppets. One was back up on his feet. All the rest were down, trying to get back up. Spin, block. An explosion sounded outside. Fuck! Someone was shooting at them. The chopper shook, banked hard to one side. Sam was thrown face first into the bulkhead. Her head collided with the hard wall. The SEAL fell atop her, got his arm around her neck in a headlock, squeezed to immobilize her. Shit! She reached back to crush his balls, hit his body armor instead, tried to kick at his knee but had no leverage on the floor. She got her fingers around his forearm. It was thicker than her calf. Fuck, he was strong. She couldn't pry him off. He squeezed harder, despite her grip. Another SEAL had a rifle aimed at her. He was trying to get a clean shot. Fuck! Her eyes landed on Cade. He was bound and gagged, staring at her with eyes wide. The knife she'd knocked out of one of their hands was across the chopper. If she could just get her hands on it, Cade was there. She willed it at him, sent him her desire. His feet were on it. He kicked, pushed it towards her. Sam pulled a hand away from the meaty arm around her neck, got one finger barely on the bottom of the knife's hilt, walked it back towards her. The headlock closed tighter. The one with the rifle almost had a clean shot on her. There! The knife was in her hand. She couldn't think, couldn't see, wasn't sure of her aim. She gripped the knife with both hands, pointed it towards his elbow, stabbed down hard. The seal behind her screamed in pain as the graphene tip came in between slabs of armor, severed tendons in his joint. His grip went limp. Sam rolled free, only to take a vicious kick to her head, another to her gut. Two guns were coming around on her. She couldn't get them both in time. The armored window of the fuselage door exploded in a shower of glass. Gunshots, groans. A black-gloved hand appeared, a pistol in it, alive with muzzle flashes. Fang's feral grin followed it in.
"Missile launch! Missile launch!" Bruce Williams exclaimed. "Both RTAF fighters have launched! Close range! Banshee's countering!"
Becker's eyes bugged out. Nichols gripped the arms of his chair. On screen, red dots streaked out from both Rudras. Indian Shiva 3 missiles, active radar homing. No lock on the Banshees yet. Was the stealth as good as promised? Both Banshees fired radar decoys. The missiles acquired locks on them instantly, swerved as the decoys put range between themselves and the choppers. An explosion lit up the night sky, then another.
"Two misses!" Williams called out.
"Get the Banshees into the clouds!"
Nichols ordered.
"Shots fired inside Banshee 1, Jane Kim said.
Nichols looked at the screen showing the interior of Banshee 1.
A Confucian fist? Shoes driver? Fucking A!
"If Blackbird gets control of that craft," Becker said.
Nichols nodded.
"Activate remote nav on Banshee 1. Have the pilot engage the lockout. Controls to us."
Jane Kim nodded.
"Roger that."
"Missile launch," Williams said. "Two more darts in the air."
Fang pushed through the shattered window, guns roaring, muzzle flashes lighting up the interior of the Banshee. He'd lost his chauffeur's hat, but the suit and gloves and shoes were still perfect. His bullets punched one seal into the bulkhead, slammed another face down against the floor of the chopper. Sam kicked up at the stunned third man, took him in the head, saw his eyes roll into the back of his head. Another explosion rocked the craft. The pilot banked them hard and fast, almost 90 degrees over. Sam braced herself as her world rotated. Fang stepped lightly onto the new floor. He moved like a dancer, unruffled by the chopper's acrobatics. Only one seal stirred. The man whose elbow Sam had stabbed was crawling on the floor, trying to reach a fallen assault rifle with his left hand. He glanced over, saw Fang and Sam, and froze, his fingers inches from the rifle. Fang held the man's eyes, shook his head.
"You don't want to do that."
The seal remained absolutely still. Sam turned her head at a noise from the cockpit. The seal lunged for the gun. Fang was there, suddenly, his foot slamming into the Navy man's head. The seal went limp. Fang shook his head again, picked up the rifle, slung it over his shoulder. Sam slid into the co-pilot's seat, her knife pointed at the chopper pilot's face. They were flying in cloud. The pilot had his hands up, empty, in surrender.
"Take us back to the monastery," Sam said.
"I can't,"
he replied.
"The hell you can't?"
She gestured with a knife in her hand.
"CNC has the controls,"
the pilot protested.
"So override him. Take control back."
The pilot shook his head.
"I punched in the lockout. No way to get the stick back."
Sam frowned.
"Why the hell did you do that?"
The pilot shrugged, glanced back at the bodies behind him, at the Chinese man in the dapper suit and black gloves, at the knife in Sam's hands.
"Orders?"
Sam shook her head.
"That wasn't the smartest thing you've ever done."
She reversed the knife, slammed the hilt of it into his face. The man went limp. Now, was there really no way to take back control of this thing? It had been a long time since basic flight. First, swipe the pilot's thumb on the biometrics. She was studying the controls when they started to move of their own accord. The chopper was turning.
"We have the stick," Jane Kim said, "bringing them back home."
"RTAF fighters have lost the Banshees," Williams said. "Looks like they can't find us in the clouds. Good cloud cover most of the way home."
Nichols relaxed just a tiny bit. They were a long way from done, but it looked like they might just pull this off. Shu thought.
There is the hole.
They'd opened it up for her themselves, just on the one helicopter, the one that Fang and Katarones and Lane were on. Shu studied the encrypted stream of commands and status data flowing back and forth, compared it to the data she'd gleaned from the Ministry of Defense database. Yes, now that they'd opened this door for her, she could control this craft. The directional antenna atop the opal came alive at her mental command. There. She reached out, and Banshee 1 began to turn. Jane Kim frowned.
Sir, Banshee 1 has stopped responding. I'm frozen out. It's starting to turn.
Did the cockpit take control back?
Had the pilot not entered the lockout code? Had it not worked? Kim tapped away at her console.
No, sir. I think it's another signal. Banshee 2 is flying a sweep, trying to triangulate. Looks like it's originating from near the target.
What the hell?
Banshee 1 is turning back towards the monastery, sir. It's losing altitude. It'll be out of the clouds soon.
Get Banshee 2 there ahead of them. Track down that signal. I want to know where it's coming from. Exactly. Get us out of the clouds and give us eyeballs if you need to. What did we miss?
Nichols wondered.
What's going on out there?
Roger that, Bruce Williams said. Popping below clouds now.
Improving triangulation,
Jane Kim reported. Telemetry data superimposed itself on the enhanced camera feed.
There, Williams called out.
The screen zoomed, a black sedan, an opal, Chinese plates, Suyong Shu. Becker's mouth turned into a hard line.
Can you take her alive? He asked.
Nichols shook his head.
Not with those fighters out there.
Becker cut the connection to the Boca Raton, dialed National Security Advisor Carolyn Price with his personal phone.
Get proof, she told him, and you'll have your clearance to go after her.
The phone picked up.
Dr. Price, we have a shot on...
I'm sorry, sir. Dr. Price is with the president. Can I ever call you back?
Fuck. This is Deputy Director Becker at ERD Enforcement. I need to speak with her urgently.
That won't be possible, sir. She's with the president.
Then get her, please.
Sorry, sir. It's an important meeting.
This is absolutely urgent.
I can see about sending her a note in a few minutes.
Fuck.
Becker ended the connection, slammed the phone down onto his desk. It was all going to be on him. Election year, he remembered. He reconnected to the Boca Raton.
Mr. Nichols, he said.
Yes, sir,
Nichols answered. The man looked flustered.
Mr. Nichols, do you concur that video shows a Chinese Confucian Fist commando attacking a U.S. military helicopter?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Nichols, does evidence show that this Confucian Fist has just killed multiple U.S. soldiers?
Yes, sir,
Nichols repeated.
Mr. Nichols, does evidence lead you to believe with a high probability that said commando is the driver and personal bodyguard of Dr. Suyong Shu?
Yes, sir.
And, Mr. Nichols, is it your professional opinion that the Chinese vehicle in your sights is engaging in electronic warfare with a U.S. military aircraft and attempting to hijack that aircraft?
Yes, sir, definitely.
Becker looked down at the phone. There would be no help. This was all going to be on his head. He looked up at Nichols. So be it.
Mr. Nichols, take out that vehicle.
Yes, sir, with pleasure.
Nichols gave the order. Banshee 2 turned nose down. It fired missiles as it lost altitude to come in low to the monastery again. The AGM-101 zoomed down at the black opal at 10 Gs. Shu felt the missiles fire. They were aimed at the car. She couldn't penetrate the security of the second helicopter, but these missiles were a different matter. They depended on an external source to inform them of their targets. She twisted their primitive minds, sent them spiraling back up at the aircraft that had fired them.
Missiles way off course, Williams reported. Coming back around at Banshee 2! Countermeasures!
Banshee 2 fired decoys port and starboard, and the missiles went after them, bracketing the stealth chopper and explosions. It flew through the flames, a black shape emerging from a roiling cloud of red and orange, dropping altitude fast for a shot at the car.
Switch to guns!
Nichols said.
Nothing with guidance.
Jane Kim nodded, relayed the orders.
Roger that, Williams said as Banshee 2 spiraled down, down, down. Firing!
Flames burst from the muzzle of the Banshee in a meters-long gout. Foot-long, spent uranium cord shells streaked out from its one-inch chain gun in rapid fire, rained down on the opal sedan, ripped it to shreds. The vehicle slumped as its suspension failed. The antenna disintegrated in the first half second. The shells found the engine and the fuel tanks and punished them, tearing sparks from the metal of the car into the escaping fumes, detonating the gasoline, sending up a 50-foot fireball that tore the car in two.
"Target killed," Williams announced.
Shu almost had the helicopter back. She could see it now, just a few hundred meters away. She would get them back, then she would turn this helicopter on its mate. Bullets rained down on the car, tearing it to shreds. The connection to the helicopter dropped in the first instance. The car nearly disintegrated, then exploded. Shu watched from the shadow of the meditation hall, angry. They'd tried to kill her, again. She reached out with her own mind for Banshee 1. It was at the extreme end of her unaided range. She just barely had her mental fingertips on it. There, she had it. It responded to her thoughts. She would bring it home, extract her people, and then show these arrogant Americans who they were fighting. Oh yes, she would show them. Then Banshee 1's masters started fighting her.
"Banshee 1 is starting to respond," Kim said. Then she grunted in frustration. "It's still fighting me. Someone else is still in there working against me."
Williams tapped to triangulate. Banshee 2 collected data points as it circled above the compound.
"Signal's weaker, but still there," Williams said. "Originating from near one of the buildings. If it's Shu, she's still alive."
"Take her out,"
Nichols ordered.
"Missile launch! Missile launch!" Williams called out. "RTAF fighters are back. 4 darts in the air."
"Fuck!" Nichols said. "Evasive maneuvers and activate the spiders. Weapons free. Shoot to kill on primary targets."
"Roger that. Weapons free."
Shu pulled the Banshee towards her. Signals from the Americans fought her, tried to turn it back. She ordered it to lose altitude. The Americans ordered it to climb. The chopper did a crazy dance in the air as they struggled over it. Shu couldn't win this, she knew. The car had been a powerful tool, now lost to her. Fighting this hard without its aid was killing her. Nexus nodes were broadcasting at emergency strength, using every watt of power they had available, exceeding their specs. Waste heat from the wattage was overheating her brain. The physical drain of the energy expenditure was draining glucose from her bloodstream, sapping her, starving this body's neurons. She dropped to one knee in the doorway. A monk saw her, came to support her. She had to end this now. Shu put everything she had into a final surge of thought, pushed the chopper down, 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 drained power from its rotors. She had one last chance to get them out. She reached out to the limit of her strength, yelled into their minds. Sam grabbed the stick as the chopper started to turn. No good. Nothing she did had any impact on the craft. A fireball burst up from the monastery ahead. Something had exploded. The chopper shuddered, started behaving erratically. They were almost there, up above the lake at the foot of the monastery now. They started to turn to the right, jerked back to the left, dropped, climbed, spun in the air, tilted and canted crazily. Sam hit controls frantically, with her hands, with the pilots, tried to get the chopper to respond to her. Nothing she did changed anything. This was crazy.
"Jump into the lake. It's your only chance."
"Shu." The controls were still unresponsive. The chopper was diving now, still doing its mad, drunken dance, jerking this way and that, losing altitude. The lake at the foot of the monastery was just 30 feet below them now. The chopper leveled out, spun, stabilized. Sam heard something beeping from the cockpit, saw the light. Missile warning. No lock. Time to go. Fang had cut Cade free of the plastic cuffs and had his arm around him. Fang hit the emergency door release button, and the door blasted outwards on explosive bolts. The night air welcomed them. There were 2 dots glowing in the sky out there, exhaust flames from the missiles. Sam heard the missile warning tone change to the lock sound. Missile warning, radar lock. Oh, fuck. Blowing the door had just blown their stealth and lit them up on radar. Fang jumped with Cade. Sam reached back on instinct, grabbed the belt of the seal whose elbow she'd stabbed, and jumped, dragging him with her. For a moment, there was stillness. She swam in cool night air. Everything receded. Then the missiles slammed into the chopper above her. Explosions filled the night with the tortured screams of metal and the deafening whoosh of superheated air. A giant force shoved her down, and the water rose up to slam into her.
"Fuck!"
Jane Kim swore. Nichols had never heard her swear before.
Banshee 1 is hit! Repeat, Banshee 1 is hit! Total loss!
Nichols glanced at the other screen. Banshee 2 had dodged its two missiles. The two Rudras would be out of missiles now. All they had left were guns.
Get 'em back into the clouds! Nichols yelled.
They're hauling ass, boss, Williams said. Climbing, climbing! 400 meters to the clouds!
On the screen, the RTAF fighters were coming back around for another pass. It was a race, and it was clear the fighters had the advantage.
Visual contact with the Rudras, Williams said, voice tense. They're opening up with guns!
On screen, muzzle flames burst out from the nose guns of the two RTAF fighters, still half a click away, 200 meters to the clouds. Nichols watched on screen as shells pounded Banshee 2, ripped off half the tail, tearing into the main rotors. The Banshee spun madly, tipped over into a 45-degree angle, rolled as it lost altitude at a sickening pace. It fell from the sky, spinning end over end, struck the mountainside at 150 miles an hour. The rotor tore into the mountain and snapped, driving metal fragments into the chopper at high speed, igniting the fuel, sending up a huge fireball as Banshee 2 tumbled into a flaming wreck down the side of the mountain.
I think we've seen enough, came the voice of the ship's captain. I'm taking us under.
No one disagreed. In a monastery dormitory building, in a recently used cell, under a hard, narrow bed, a slate screen came back to life. Connection restored. 14 minutes remaining. 49. Vermin. Cade came back to consciousness in the back of a pickup truck, driving up a steep and winding road. He was wrapped in a blanket and soaking wet. Fang had an arm around him. The Chinese soldier had lost his suit jacket and gloves somewhere, was down to a sodden white dress shirt and slacks. Sam was on the other side, bald-headed in drenched nun's robes, with a gun trained on an unconscious Navy SEAL. Cade coughed. It was a wet cough. Water this time instead of fire. Maybe he'd be buried alive next time. Or vacuum. Yeah, vacuum. Sam caught the gist of his thoughts, chuckled at him.
You're alive, Cade. Be happy.
Totally fucking thrilled.
Sam and Fang both laughed.
We get you in front of a fire, yeah?
Fang said. Cade nodded. That sounded good. He was shivering, even in the warm Thai air. Shu met them at the top. She was a sight for sore eyes. She hugged Fang, hugged Cade, even hugged Sam. Fang carried Cade off towards the massive hearth in the kitchen. The whole monastery was in chaos. There were army trucks with mounted machine guns and micro-missile launchers. Ananda was talking to a military officer. Conscious monks were dragging unconscious monks to the meditation hall as a makeshift infirmary. Sam threw the big seal over her shoulder, looking comical carrying such a bigger man, and said she was going to get him tended to and handed over to the Thai military. Shu said she had to speak to Ananda. The kitchen had half a dozen Thai cooks in it. They were making giant pots of tea, even bigger pots of soup. Fang found a chair for Cade, dragged it to the hearth, deposited Cade in it almost gently. Everything hurt inside again. The Confucian fist found the smallest of the pots, poured tea for both of them, brought a mug of it to Cade.
Thank you, Fang. And thank you for saving us. I owe you.
Fang nodded, crouched down in front of the hearth near Cade.
You should thank Su Young,
he said.
This will cost her.
Cade nodded.
I will.
It'll cost her how? Fang looked at the fire.
Bosses in China. They won't like this. Very messy. Very public. She played a lot of cards.
Cade didn't know what to say. He stayed quiet. Fang kept staring at the flames.
You know, when we meet, you call me robot, slave?
Cade nodded.
Yeah.
Fang nodded back, still staring into the roaring fire.
I'm free. I'm free because of her.
He swallowed tea.
I choose to serve my country now. But more than that, I choose her.
Su Young Shu chose that moment to enter, a smile on her face. She radiated relief and resolve.
Only one dead, she said. one monk, anyway. Everyone else will be fine. And the Thai are beefing up defenses here. The Americans can't try that again without declaring war.
Cade felt a shortness in his chest. Which one? Shu looked at him quizzically, without understanding. Which monk? The one that died, what was his name?
Ah, she said. A novice. He was hit, and then broke his neck falling down a flight of stairs. Bon.
Bon. Cade stared down at his tea. Another one dead.
You shouldn't look so glum, Shu began.
Then her eyes lost focus. She was far away. Cade and Fang both looked up at her in alarm. Her eyes regained focus. She exuded shock, anger. She stared at Cade.
What have you done?
Spider BR-6721 lurked in the corner of the room. Combat status had been initiated 37 minutes ago at 0108 local time. The active engagement protocol, previously observe, was now terminate. Weapons free. Find and eliminate primary targets. BR-6721 slowly walked around the room, in the long corner where the wall met ceiling, identifying targets. It was in this mode when possible matches primary target Gamma and tertiary target Sigma entered the room. BR-6721 slowly crawled along the ceiling to get a better view. Yes, with high confidence, the two human-shaped objects were primary target Gamma and tertiary target Epsilon. Even as it confirmed this, primary target Alpha entered the area. Human control was currently offline. BR-6721 reviewed its instructions and combat status again. The active engagement protocol was terminate. These were valid targets. Weapons were free. Not having access to human control, it conferred with its sisters as it slowly and stealthily moved towards its targets. The responses came back even as it reached firing range. Greater than 95% of reachable sisters agreed with its conclusions. Spider BR-6721 steadied itself against wall and ceiling, extruded the tiny launcher for its neurotoxin micro-darts, loaded up its clip, and fired a controlled burst.
What have you done?
Shu demanded of him.
Ow!
Something stung Cade on his right hand. He looked down in annoyance and surprise, saw a prick of blood there. Fang was moving, intense alarm emanating from him. The Confucian fist was already at the stovetop, a giant pot of boiling water in his hands. He flung the water at something high up on the wall, jumped forward, brought the pot itself down on something that fell to the ground, again and again and again. Su Yong Shu had fallen to her knees, between Cade and the fire. There was a spot of blood on the side of her neck. Fang turned to her. There was a spot of blood on his chest. Cade's hand was numb. He couldn't feel it anymore.
Neurotoxin,
Shu said softly.
Save the boy.
Fang whirled. There was a chopping knife in his hand, a giant cleaver. Cade's eyes went wide. Fang, no! Fang's free hand came down on Cade's wrist. He raised the cleaver high. Cade tried to pull his arm away. It was like trying to pull it out of a steel manacle.
Fang, no!
He screamed.
No!
Firelight turned the cleaver's blade red. The world slowed to a crawl. Cade had time to see a tiny twitch of a muscle on Fang's face, a tightening of tendons in his wrist, and then the man's expression hardened and the cleaver came down, 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 whistling in a long arc through the air, glinting in the firelight as it fell, until it came clean through Cade's forearm and embedded itself deep into the wood of the chair with a meaty thunk. Cade jerked back. His upper arm came away. His right hand was gone, his whole right arm from an inch below the elbow. There was no pain at first, just shock.
What? What? What?
Cade screamed in horror and shock, screamed as the pain hit him. Fang was wrapping something just below Cade's bicep now, his belt. He squeezed it tight, tourniqueting him. Cade saw again that there was a pinprick of blood on the right side of Fang's shirt. Cade stopped screaming, just stared. On the arm of the chair where he'd been sitting, his hand, the hand that had been his, was turning gray. The fingers were twitching. He turned, saw Shu. Her face was going gray. She touched his mind. The pain ceased. The shock didn't. Fang was at her side now, sucking at the wound at the side of her neck, spitting out the toxin as fast as he could pull it out of her. It was no use. Cade could see that in her mind. He just stared.
Kate,
Shu sent.
They've tried to kill me again.
Her thoughts were weak. Her mind was fraying.
Again.
He could see it now. He understood. The fire that had killed her mentor, Yang Wei, the limo wreck. Yang Wei trapped in the seat next to her, where her husband was supposed to be. He was screaming, burning to death. She was burning to death as well. Her hair was on fire. Her legs were crushed, pinned in the wreck beside Yang Wei. Her skin was blackening. Something had embedded itself in her abdomen. Blood was gushing out. Her lungs were filling up with smoke. The unborn baby in her womb, not Ling, an earlier child, an unborn son. The surgical bed, the shaved head. She hadn't been sick. She'd been mortally wounded. She was dying of the burns, her lungs filling up with fluid, her immune system failing, infections blooming inside her. A desperate measure. The work she and her husband and Ted Prat-Nung had been doing. The nanites that burrowed through the blood-brain barrier, burrowed through neuronal tissue, recording everything, heedless of the damage they did to cells in their haste to preserve data. The process that digitized the structure of her brain, the process that had failed every time before her. No hope for her body, only one chance for her mind. Too late for her unborn son. Pain, fear, confusion, transcendence. Hatred. They'd tried to kill her. They'd tried to kill her husband. They'd killed her mentor instead. They'd killed her unborn son instead. They'd made her into something else, something that despised them, something that would destroy them. The tapestry of her thoughts was degenerating into mere threads.
Fang,
she sent him.
Trust Fang.
No, he sent her. You don't have to hate. No! It was too late. She was gone. This clone body had died. Fang was on his feet, yelling in Thai. His mouth was red with Shu's blood. More blood had splattered his white shirt. There was a tiny hole in the shirt where a neurotoxin dart had struck him, but still he lived. Cade couldn't understand the words the man yelled, but he got their drift.
Spiders! Spiders! Assassins! Find them! Destroy them!
Cade was still in the chair in front of the fire, Suyong Shu's gray, lifeless body slumped on his lap, his stump of an arm tourniqueted in Fang's belt, when Sam and Ananda found him. Briefing. Naxus's ability to satisfy widespread human desires, combined with its innocuous perception, suggests that were the technology to ever enter the mainstream, the genie would prove very difficult to put back into the bottle. Nexus, a risk assessment, 2033. ERD Library Series, 2039. Classified, secret. 50. Going viral. The battle over distribution of the Nexus 5 files lasted just under 31 hours. It began at 2:21 p.m. EST on Sunday, April 29th. An anonymous slate connected to an AsiaComNet access satellite began uploading large compressed packages to file-sharing services around the world, posting them to bulletin boards, distributing links to prominent news sites and scientific paper exchanges worldwide. Automated sensor demons in the United States detected the new files, noted their linkage to terms on the demons' watch lists, and the speed with which the files were spreading. They alerted their human operators and instituted temporary blocks of the files at the North American Electronic Shield firewall. 15 miles south of Baltimore, at Fort George G. Meade Army Base, inside a 20-story cube of steel and black reflective glass, National Security Agency on-call supervisors started seeing alerts from their demons. Someone was distributing files that claimed to show how to synthesize Nexus 3 and how to convert that into Nexus 5. Demons were instructed to disrupt transfer of the files worldwide. A supervisor flagged the event and forwarded it to the International Clearinghouse on Global Technological Threats. Systems in Europe, China, Russia, Japan, India, and 80 other nations received bulletins instantly. Many of them were already aware of the outbreak and had initiated their own measures. Across 2/3 of the internet nodes on the planet, propagation of the files halted. supervisors congratulated themselves. Fast action and international cooperation had saved humanity from a post-human threat once again. At 3:38 p.m. EST, a teenager in Portland, Oregon, who downloaded the files before the interdiction, repackaged and reposted them to a peer-to-peer sharing site with a new name. Badass Neuro Shit You Should Check Out from Axon and Synapse. The name referred to the credited authors of the neural software contained in several of the files. Other users of the peer-sharing service began downloading it, distributing the files to their computers, which in turn offered it up to others. At 4:08 p.m. EST, the files were cross-posted to a San Francisco music fan list with the comment, "Is this the same as DJ Axon? Is this really how you make Nexus?" Demons that had found no new copies of the files in more than an hour took notice of this new distribution. The demons logged the new file signatures, used emergency privileges to access the internal systems of every bandwidth provider in the United States, added the file signatures to the block list. The signatures were broadcast immediately to cooperating agencies worldwide, all of which invoked similar powers. Spread of the data was once again halted. At least 450 computers, slates, and phones around the world had downloaded the files, and possibly more. Supervisors paged managers, picked up the phone to confer with their peers in other countries. Emergency staff were called to the office. Other filtering and blocking priorities were lowered to make room for more CPU cycles and more human eyes on this issue. Access to neuroscience papers and health articles mentioning the synapses or axons of neurons became spotty. Emails, texts, and online posts mentioning those terms and others began to bounce mysteriously or disappear silently, never to reach their intended targets. At 6:11 p.m. EST, an adult film star, sunning herself in Miami in the late stages of what had been an epic weekend bender, posted that she'd always wanted to experience what her lovers felt when they fucked her, and maybe this would do the trick. She posted a link to the banned files. In the next 3 minutes, 48,000 of her fans clicked the link, only to find their requests denied. A few hundred continued to search, found other links to a claimed Nexus 5 download, found that absolutely none of them worked, and began to speculate as to why. Their speculations, in turn, began to be rejected by their net providers or to disappear from the net soon after posting, fueling more and more speculation. At 9:44 p.m. EST, conspiracy sites hosted in Mexico began to post that U.S. censors were blocking a new set of terms and files on the net. Civil libertarians forwarded on the posts aggressively. By 10:30 p.m. EST, demons and supervisors at the NSA had identified and put down more than 80 new distributions of the original files, each of them using a new name to describe the contents and changing compression or file length to change the file signatures in an attempt to confuse automated sensors. Demons were given broad discretion to filter first, ask questions later. NSA officials were cautiously optimistic. The files were spreading, but slowly. It had not gone viral. They could contain this. That optimism lasted nearly 9 hours. At 7:28 a.m. EST, Monday morning, demons began reporting suspected new hits, dozens of suspected new hits at various confidence levels, hundreds of suspected new hits, thousands of suspected new hits, each with a different file name and signature. A previously unknown hacker named Mutator had taken the original package and mutated it into a plethora of new variants, adding new and irrelevant files, reordering the existing files, padding out the beginning or end with texts from the Bible, the Congressional Register, random sites on the web, recompressing the package using thousands of different combinations of parameters. Each member of the new generation had a new name, sometimes nonsensical, often misspelled, new characters inserted, characters deleted, synonyms and slang and numbers substituted for original terms, words reordered. Each had a new file signature. Tens of thousands of compromised machines began to spew the files out, emitting more than 1 million unique packages. They hit peer-sharing sites, media sites, news sites, scientific paper repositories, sent emails to anyone who'd posted on various science or drug-related sites, and more. Filter demons caught well over 90% of them. Tens of thousands got through. Each downloaded package unleashed a new generation of distribution packages upon opening. The net was soon awash in new mutants descended from the variants that made it past the filter demons. Some variants prompted the users who downloaded the package to enter new file names' names to add to the next generation. Evolution and human cleverness were cast against filter demon cleverness. Bit by bit, crowdsourced evolution pulled ahead. NSA agents were slow to grasp the enormity of the new outbreak. When they did, they pulled the plug on all peer-sharing traffic within the United States, started to systematically sandbox any computer identified as a source of the new infection, used backdoors and email systems to try to filter out new generations of the files. It was too late. By then, the files and the code to make new pseudo-randomized generations had reached more than 30,000 systems worldwide. Within the United States, the NSA's efforts barely held back the wave of propagation. In Mexico, in Uzbekistan, in Brazil, in Algeria, in Turkey, in Croatia, in Kenya, in Indonesia, in South Africa, in Vietnam, in dozens of other countries, Nexus 5 spread like wildfire. American, Chinese, European, and Indian authorities waged a coordinated fight against the outbreak for another 14 hours. They used previously hidden backdoors in foreign systems to install filters against the files, deployed massive botnets to take down servers hosting the files, yanked internet address allocations from particularly troublesome regions, sent whole parts of the global net dark for hours. Businesses stalled, stock markets crashed, traffic jams erupted as smart routing turned dumb. Power grids went haywire. Automated factories and trains shut themselves down. Pilots took manual control of errant aircraft, swamped the few human air traffic controllers with the flood of requests for instructions. It wasn't enough. Every hour, more variants of the package appeared, mutated, replicated. At 9:08 p.m. EST on Monday, the NSA declared failure to control the propagation of the files outside the United States, sent home the exhausted staff who'd been fighting the infestation for nearly 31 hours. Around the globe, the battle over distribution slowed, and curiosity about what had been distributed grew. In Madrid, a psychiatrist read the write-up of the experiments with great interest. There might very well be clinical utility in a drug that allowed therapist and client to connect mentally. Was it truly possible? In Hyderabad, a serial entrepreneur and a tech financer brainstormed together about this new technology. Was there a way to make money off of it? Was there a scalable business here? Could they grab a first-mover advantage? How could they skirt the Copenhagen restrictions? Just how much funding would they need? In the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles, an adult film producer mused on the possibilities of making and selling adult films using this new medium. No, not just films. They'd be adult adventures. Yes, that would sell. He picked up the phone, dialed his drug connection. He needed some Nexus 3. On the island of Bali, a burnt-out German businessman who'd spent the last year smoking hashish on the beach and doing ecstasy at island rave parties every weekend paged through the files with growing enthusiasm. This sounded wicked. In a slum of Lahore, an Islamist imam contemplated the best way to employ this tool to further the jihad. At the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, a lieutenant general sent out a memo requesting an assessment of the use of Nexus 5 and related technologies for advanced battlefield coordination. In Rio de Janeiro, a 38-year-old lawyer looked at his husband of 12 years. Could this help save their marriage? In Paris, the mother of an autistic boy looked longingly at her son. What would it be like to touch his mind? Was it even possible? Could it break through the walls between them? In Istanbul, a college student read and reread the synthesis instructions for Nexus 3. His university chemistry lab had the feedstock for this. Could he hack the autosynth to produce it? His cousin Hassan was good with software. He grabbed his phone, dialed Hassan. This could be fun. Around the world, tens of thousands of people wondered about this new thing called Nexus 5. Within days, hundreds of them had tried it. In a darkened office in Washington, D.C., Martin Holtzman contemplated the vial of Nexus in his hand. The world was changing. Nexus 5 was now a fact of life. He devoted much of his life to greater understanding of the mind. And now thousands, millions around the world were going to get this technology that his organization had tried so hard to keep locked up. He was tired of being left behind. He was tired of watching progress from the sidelines. Holtzman pulled the top off the vial, tipped it into his mouth, and began to drink. 100 yards away, Warren Becker sat at his desk, contemplating a tiny green pill. The memo from legal had arrived this morning. Document retention was now in effect. He was to destroy no files, no recordings, electronic or otherwise, pending further investigation. The subpoena had arrived in the afternoon. The Senate Select Committee on Homeland Security, Senator Barbara Engel's chair, he was to be a witness in an upcoming hearing. He understood. He was a pawn in this game. And now the other side would put him to their use. They'd drag him in front of the cameras. They'd use him to disgrace the president. They'd use him to disgrace the ERD. They'd use him to weaken the one organization that was fighting hardest to protect them all, the one organization that none of them could afford to weaken at a time like this. Maximilian Barnes had arrived last, after business hours, after the office had gone dark and quiet.
"The president values your loyalty," Barnes had said. "He values your courage. He wants to thank you for your service. He takes care of his own and of their loved ones."
Of course, the president's friends would take care of his family. They always did. His girls would want for nothing. Nothing except a father. Becker hadn't even noticed Maximilian Barnes placed the pill on the desk, but there it was. He knew damn well what that pill was. Undetectable, they said. A fast-metabolizing trigger of myocardial infarction. It would be gone from his bloodstream in less than an hour. It would look like a natural heart attack. That much was true. Painless, they said. Quick. Becker knew those for the lies they were. He'd seen men who'd taken this way out, their limbs contorted in agony, their teeth chipped from the force with which they'd clenched their jaws, chairs tipped over, lamps broken, furniture and detritus strewn about them from the involuntary throes of their deaths. Not painless, not quick. He had insurance. He knew things he shouldn't know. He had leverage. And using any of it would destroy this administration, would destroy the ERD, would destroy everything he'd spent the last 9 years fighting for. Becker turned to his terminal. He used his privileges to silence any alarms, used his override to lower its firewalls. He pulled up the net address from memory, an address that was given only in person, only in secret, only to those who might someday need to clean up after themselves to protect the president. He clicked the link he found there, said yes to the security prompt. The worm would wreak havoc. It would start with his own system's logs. They'd never be able to prove that he'd invited it in. From there, it would spread, destroying everything it found, until someone or something stopped it. Becker reached down, pulled out the bottle and glass from his bottom drawer, poured himself 2 fingers of Lafroig. He wished he could see the girls one more time, hold them, tell them he loved them, tell Claire how very much. He was a good soldier. Above all else, he was that. He put the pill on his tongue, washed it down with the Lafroig. The amber liquid burned on the way down. It brought him no comfort. Becker poured himself 2 fingers more and settled back to wait, settled back to die. 51. Shanghai. In a luxury apartment, 80 floors above Shanghai, a little girl named Ling gazed absently down on the city. The people moved like ants. The highways were like rivers. Her tutor called to her in Mandarin.
"Ling, we must finish our studies now."
Ling ignored her. There was nothing this woman could teach her that she couldn't learn twice as fast, 10 times as fast from the net. She opened herself to it, felt the pulse of it, the flow of it, the almost primal energy of it. It was qi, she'd decided. The qi of the world, the life force of the planet, was data. She'd shared that thought with no one. They'd think she was quite odd. even more than they did already. She'd shared the thought with no one but her mother, that is. She shared everything with her mother. Her mother. Her mother had died the death of the body. Her mother's mind lived on, but it was constrained now. The old men that ruled this country were punishing her, cutting her off from the outside world, cutting her off from Ling. Ling didn't like that, not one bit, and she didn't intend to stand for it.
Ling,
her tutor called.
Come here now.
Ling put her sweetest little girl smile on her face, the smile that showed her teeth. She turned back to her tutor. It was important to at least pretend to be human. That's what her mother always said. In a secret barracks on the outskirts of Shanghai, 36 identically faced men moaned uneasily in their sleep, tossed and turned from side to side. They dreamt of violence. They dreamt of fire. They dreamt of death. They woke in a ripple of consciousness. Their mother had died. Their mother was in danger. They rose as one, checked their weapons, checked their bodies. Somewhat calmed by this, they returned to their bunks and eventually to sleep. Their mother might need them soon. In a secret complex below Xiao Tong University's computer science campus, a distinguished-looking Chinese man in a suit stood, hands clasped behind his back. He gazed thoughtfully through the armored and insulated glass into the vast room beyond, where banks upon banks of quantum processors were ensconced in liquid helium pressure vessels. Red and blue lights blinked softly, showing the status of parts of the computing apparatus.
Wife?
Chen Pang asked softly.
What have you done?
Briefing. Thai claim American forces attacked monastery, killed monk. Monday, 6:42 p.m., Bangkok, Thailand. American News Network. Authorities in Bangkok today showed off substantial evidence that they say proves that American forces attacked a monastery inside Thai borders. The evidence includes helicopter wreckage, weapons, numerous bodies, and a prisoner claimed to be American Navy SEAL Sergeant Jim Iverson. Prime Minister Chao Phraya of Thailand angrily denounced the United States this morning and threatened to pull Thailand out of the Copenhagen Accords on global technological threats. The State Department has officially denied the allegation that the U.S. forces were involved, calling it ridiculous and the evidence fabricated, and referring to Thailand as an important but misguided ally. If Thailand does withdraw from the Copenhagen Accords, it would be only the third country since... Warren Becker, ERD Enforcement Deputy Director, found dead. Tuesday, 7:12 a.m., Washington, D.C., Washington Post. The D.C. Metropolitan Police Department has confirmed this morning that ERD Enforcement Deputy Director Warren Becker was found dead late last night in his office from an apparent heart attack. Becker, 49, leaves behind his wife Claire and two daughters, ages 15 and 13. Police say foul play is not suspected at this time. A full coroner's report is expected tomorrow. Anonymous sources on Capitol Hill report that Becker was expected to be a witness in upcoming hearings of the Senate Select Committee on Homeland Security. Committee staffers declined to comment. Epilogue. Crossroads. On the third morning since Xu's death, Sam and Cade sat together atop one of the monastery's stone walls and watched the sun come over the horizon. The monastery had changed. Only a crater remained where Xu's car had been. The courtyards and buildings crawled with Thai armed forces, with their jeeps and their guns and their missile launchers guarding against another American attack. Out over the Thai plains, they caught a glimpse of an RTAF jet flying a patrol around them, its silver skin glinting in the early morning sun. Sam and Cade sat in silence. What now? Cade wondered. What will people do with Nexus? There would be atrocities, that he was sure of. Would there be positive effects? He couldn't be certain, but he could dream. He could dream Ilya's dream, of a world where people were free to become more than what they were. He could dream Watts's dream, of a world where people could better understand each other, a world where that mutual understanding brought peace. He could dream Rangan's dream, of a world where every night was a party, and every time was a good time. The thoughts made him smile. He had his own dreams, A 1,000 minds connected, 1,000,000 minds, 1,000,000,000 minds. What kind of ferocious intelligence could they wield together? What would they learn about themselves, about the mind and the brain, about the universe around them? Would they still be human at the end of this? Might they be something more? Cade looked down at the stump of his right arm. He wasn't fully human himself anymore. Gecko genes had been injected into his cells there. Over the coming weeks, they'd send new growth outwards. In a few months, perhaps, he'd have a hand again. Or perhaps he'd develop tumors. It remained to be seen. There was no way back. No way back on either front.
Conflict is inevitable,
Shu had said after their dinner.
You have to decide if you're on the side of progress or of stagnation.
I'm on the side of peace, he'd replied, and freedom.
I hope I did the right thing,
he thought to himself.
Only fools are always certain of themselves,
Ananda had told him. He glanced at Sam to his left. She was staring out into the landscape, watching the line of dawn crawl down the mountain and onto the plains. It was a wonder she didn't hate him. She, of all people, understood the dangers of what he'd unleashed on the world. Sam spoke without looking at him.
I'm in no position to judge, Cade. You did what you thought was right, what you thought would help people most. I guess, right now, I guess that's as good as anything.
Cade smiled faintly. She'd picked up on his thoughts again. It was happening more and more often, with all they'd been through together, with the hours of meditation every day and night.
It's beautiful,
Sam said. Cade smiled.
You're sure you don't need me?
She asked. He took her hand with the one that remained to him.
Fang is coming with me,
he answered.
With luck, the Chinese think he's dead. And you did what Watts asked. You kept me safe until I released Nexus. That's what he wanted. He thought it could save the world.
Neither of them said anything for a time. They sat, hand in hand, and watched the sun rise higher into the sky.
Let's hope he was right,
Sam replied. It was time to go. Sam helped Cade down from the wall, put his left arm over her shoulder, helped him hop over to the vehicles to where Fang was waiting. Ananda had kept them safe thus far. They'd given their statements to Thai National Intelligence. Ananda had pulled strings to keep them out of jail, out of the hands of the army or the police. That wouldn't last. Even his friendship with the king had limits. It was time to move on. Sam helped Cade take a seat on the lowered gate of the old pickup. Fang was there. He hugged Sam, and to Cade's surprise, Sam hugged back. After a long moment, Fang pulled back, kept his hands on her upper arms, looked her in the eye.
You'll be okay?
He asked. Sam nodded.
Becker's dead. The UN's in an uproar. There are hearings being scheduled in Washington. They won't come after me for a while. I'm safe for a bit.
Fang nodded. He hugged her again. They held each other for a moment and then separated.
Take care of that one,
Sam said, gesturing at Cade. Fang grinned.
You got it.
Cade accepted Fang's help into the bed of the truck. The Chinese ex-soldier tapped on the glass at the rear of the cab, shouted something in Thai, and off they went, on a long and bumpy ride towards the border with Cambodia, and from there to destinations as yet unknown. Sam watched them go until they rounded a final bend in the mountain road and were lost from sight. She turned and faced south. There, near a tiny village on the border with Malaysia, there were more children like Mai. That was where her road led now. She turned back to the east, stared into the dawn. After all these days of rain, the sun felt good on her face. Sam closed her eyes, took a deep breath of the clean morning air, and went to meet her own transport south. Briefing. Video transcript. A final thought. Ileana Alexander, recorded Sunday, February 19th, 2040, 1:18 a.m. Simone Field, California. Ileana Alexander faces the camera. She's wearing a pale green dress with a gauzy purple scarf around her neck. She speaks with a slight Russian accent. Electronic music and sounds of voices are heard in the background.
If you're watching this video, then I haven't been able to reach the net for at least 7 days. I'm dead, imprisoned, or disappeared, most likely at the hands of the U.S. government. My parents brought me to the United States of America when I was 10. They were fleeing the fascism that had taken hold in my native Russia. They chose the U.S. over all other nations because they viewed this country as the world's leading pillar of freedom, of individual liberty. That was then. This is now.
Alexander looks down, shakes her head.
The crime for which I've been disappeared is that of attempting to give people tools with which to empower themselves. In the America of 2040, that's no longer a welcome activity. Our so-called leaders and their bureaucrats have drawn lines around what it means to be human. Anyone who steps beyond those lines is, by definition, no longer a person, no longer endowed with inalienable rights, no longer protected from the whims of those in power.
Alexander shakes her head, keeping her eyes on the camera.
This is the same logic of inhumanity that's been applied in the past to slaves, to women, to Jews, to members of any group which those in power wished to persecute. Every attempt through history to limit the definition of humanity has been a prelude to the subjugation, degradation, and slaughter of innocents, everyone. By drawing a box around humanity, those in power are telling each of us what we can and can't do with our minds, with our bodies, and in the interests of our children. They're saying that they're smarter than we are, that we need their protection from ourselves. Needless to say, I disagree. Power is best when it's distributed most broadly. That's what democracy means. That's what freedom means. The right to determine your individual destiny belongs in your hands and in no one else's. The laws that limit human capabilities are exercises in control. They stem from fear. Fear of the future, fear of change, fear of people who might be different than we are, who might make themselves into something new. The result of this fear is the corrosion of our liberties, the corrosion of our right to determine our own futures, to chart our own destinies, to do the best we can for our children. That corrosion has consequences. If you're watching this, it's had consequences for me. Parts of our government are empowered by the Chandler Act and other laws to target, spy on, arrest, jail, and even murder Americans and foreigners accused of taking their destinies in their own hands, in complete secrecy, without a jury, without any due process, except one of a handful of National Security Court judges, all of whose names are also secret. By law, with nothing but the writ of one of a handful of politicians or appointed officials, you can be assassinated, detained, or disappeared. If you're watching this, then the ERD has used those laws to come for me, to stop me and people I work with from giving others more control over their own minds and bodies. Tomorrow, they may come for someone you know. The next day, they may come for you. This is no longer America. We've allowed our fear of change to override our adherence to our own most precious values. We've caved on our principles in order to bolster our security. That is not the America I know and love. This is not the America my parents fled Russia to find. Benjamin Franklin once wrote, "Those who would sacrifice essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. Our fears have led us to make this fool's bargain. I believe we've sacrificed essential liberties. I hope you'll prove me wrong." If you're watching this, then it's probably too late for me. But it's not too late for everyone. We don't have to sacrifice freedom for safety. We don't have to give up progress to stop terror. We don't have to hand control over our lives to faceless bureaucrats and secret police.
Alexander raises a clenched fist in view of the camera. There are tears in her eyes. Her expression is firm, committed.
This video will go out by as many channels as I can find. I'm posting it to servers across the world, just in case. Even so, I don't know if it will reach any of you. If it does, please forward it on. Mask it, mutate it, disguise it. Route it around their filters. We are only as strong as our signal. Only as strong as our voices. Don't rely on this message alone. Record your own thoughts. Write your own essays. Express yourself. Fight for what's right. Fight for your right to decide who and what sort of person you're going to be tomorrow, no matter what anyone else thinks.
Alexander pauses, fist still raised, stares at the camera, mouth hard.
This is Ilyana Alexander, signing off for the last time.
Keep up the fight. Video ends. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Nexus by Ramez Nam. Copyright 2013 by Ramez Nam. Performed by Luke Daniels. Directed by Eric Daw. Engineered by Stephen Jacoby. Performance copyright 2013 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Angry Robot on Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.